invitation.
Thank you.
Lord God, we thank you for the opportunity to first off live in this magnificent place, this beautiful county, clean air, clean water, good people. Lord, we thank you for that privilege. Second, we thank you for the privilege of being on this board to try to work for the betterment of everyone in this community, to do the best job that we can to have a well-planned out, well-thought-out community. We thank you for the privilege of being chosen for that, Lord. Help us to go through our meeting to make all the proper decisions and the best decisions that we can. When this meeting is over, go with us to our homes, our families, and our friends. Be with us as we try to do our jobs, as we go through our Thanksgiving vacation. Help us to remember the meaning of Thanksgiving and to give all praise to you, Lord, for all of the wonderful things that you've given us. Go with us to our homes, our families, and friends. Keep us safe and be with us at that next meeting. We ask in the name. Amen.
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Did anyone have anything they wanted to say at this time before we start the meeting? Okay. Approval of agenda. Do we have any agenda additions? If not, can I have a motion to
approve the agenda submitted?
Thank you, Henry.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Approval of minutes.
The only thing I can see in the minutes is on page 2. It's the next to the last line. It says College Park instead of College of Walk.
I wondered about that. Is it? I thought maybe College Walk was part of College Park. I didn't know, but okay. I'll have to correct that. Beth and I went over it. There was another, if you noticed it, on our noise ordinance, we corrected 9151. Okay, that was a little confusing. I forget what page that was on. Oh, it's on page 3, fourth bullet down. 9-1 should read 5-1. Page 3?
5-1.
Yeah, it's 5-1, yeah. Then there were just a couple of others. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes as corrected?
So moved.
Thank you, Henry.
Second.
Kimsey seconded, okay. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. The CLG presentation to the planning board.
I propose that I will introduce our speakers today, which is Michael M. Williams and Susan Zerfond. And I wrote down everything about all your greatness. So what I would like to do is, you guys, even though you won't say it, you can give them a word about the most important thing is the social work. When we were looking for this grant we got about getting history of the African American community, it's an architectural survey. Partially. So, but one of the things that was important is to determine what buildings were important, and it's not always what it looks like, but what happened there. So, a big component of this was getting oral histories. And not everyone is very good at doing that, so we went and found the experts at that. And so, they're going to, you can, come on, please. Aren't you up there as well? You need to tell them. Introduce yourself.
Okay.
I've got it written down, but you're better than me.
I'm Michael Ann Williams, and I am a folklorist as well as a historic preservationist. Started my career, in fact, in Western North Carolina with the Henderson County Survey a long time ago. Did surveys of Cherokee County, Swain, Grand Counties, and then worked at Western Carolina University, Mountain Heritage Center. Yeah, my husband, who's a native of Macon County, and then spent several decades teaching folklore and historic preservation at Western Kentucky University, so I went from one Western to another, and retired 2 years ago, and we've been in the process of moving back to Franklin area, my husband's hometown. And really what I wrote my dissertation on was using oral history to study buildings, so that's been one of the areas of my specialty. And when Beth King, who's with the survey program of Archives and History, contacted me about this project, I thought, oh, this is great, but I thought it'd be a lot more fun as a retired person to have somebody to do it with. And so I immediately thought of a former student of mine, Cindy Baritone, who's from Eastern Tennessee, so she knows the general culture of the region. She was a preservation and folklore student at Western Kentucky, and then is currently working on her doctorate at Ohio State, and is working on her dissertation in Gatlinburg. So, anything else you want to say? Thank you very much for inviting us to this presentation, and it's really been a great honor to get chosen to do this project. It was really an amazing time this summer. There's so much more that could be done, particularly with oral history, and we sort of hope that people keep on running. So we have a we gave a community presentation 2 months ago, and I think there was a conflict of days that worked for the community and days that worked for the planning board. So we said we'd come back and give it again. So
I'm glad you did.
Okay. And if there's anything that is not particularly clear, if I'm talking too fast, talking too slow, you want to wrap up, just let me know. In part of our report, Walking Around the World, and we took that quote from our very first interview, which was with Elsie Bessel, who was just about to turn 90. And so he had this great experience. He actually attended the very first Rosenwald School. I think was the only interviewee that remembered the original school. And he talked about, as a kid, wandering through all the various neighborhoods. And every tiny little area had its own name. And going up as far as Pinnacle, above where the Brevard Music Center was, and they'd do this on a Sunday afternoon. He said when there was a kid, they called it Walking Around the World. And that kind of caught, I think, the sort of sense of freedom, at least within the sort of inner joy of African-American communities. And then thanks to all the people that sponsored North Carolina State Historic Preservation Office, and now Andy McDonald's Conflict, National Trust for Historic Preservation, who helped provide some of the money for the oral history component. This was really revolutionary. Although Archives and History has been very good about doing vernacular architecture, they generally have not funded projects that have oral history components. And of course, all of you and the Joint Historic Preservation Commission. And then the CLT subcommittee. And all these people were wonderful in helping in various ways, and we really could not have done the project without all these wonderful people. Rebecca, of course, and Marcy from the library, Edith, who is a trove of history, Nicola, who really helped coordinate a lot of the interviews. And then the people that were really like to think of as our teachers, too, and the people that we did the interviews with, Elsie, a whole bunch of people who went to Rosenwald, Edith, Sheila, Kate, Wilma, Clairville Smith, Mary Alice Moody, Jim Ballard. And then two phone interviews, one phone interview with two people, Charles Young and Clifford Outlaw. They were good friends from when they were little, and one was in New Jersey and one was in Florida. And it could have been a real mess, but it was so much fun because they were kind of bouncing off of each other, remembering their childhoods. And then also people that kind of served as guides to various parts of the county or various communities. Mac Morrow, who literally showed us the lay of the land and that's wrong. Patty Stahl, who really organized a lot, Cedar Mountain with the service quarters, Wilma Lewis, who took us to her mom's home and around some of the neighborhoods, Tim Ballard, who showed us the cemetery at Davidson, Anso Cleveland, again at Cedar Mountain, Keith Parker and Jimmy Cantrell with the house that's quite possibly a slave house. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And although African American history has been underrepresented in the surveys, it's certainly not the case that there has not been a lot of research on African Americans. So we really had kind of a rich history to build on. And certainly Nathaniel Hall's history is kind of a foundation because he went to Rosenwald himself, grew up in the community, and his history draws from an oral history that goes back into the 19th century. A lot of that information would have been lost otherwise. The TCIO booklet that came out in 2000, the comprehensive survey that was done by Deborah Thompson back in the 90s. Deborah did a very good job of capturing a lot of the significant properties that were built before 1930, but unfortunately, because there were only about less than 15 among 5,000 properties, in the narrative in the books, the African American history doesn't carry very much representation. Of course, Betty Reed's Brevard Roosevelt School Book, the work that Nicholas done with Morning Glory Inspirations and the African American Storyline, all the resources at the Transylvania County Library. When we started, we had an 8-page bibliography that they've gone through and found. So we spent a couple of weeks, but we would spend a whole lot longer. And Marcy was great in helping. And then the amazing documentation that Marlon Guest Jones has done on the African American cemeteries here at Bailey's Cooper, Shady Grove, and French Bronze. So that's what we started working with. The resources for African American history before the Civil War are, of course, very scarce. We believe that there were people of African descent that came into southwestern North Carolina in the 18th century, escaped slaves, people accompanying Cherokee. But the first that have been documented, obviously, were people who came into this region in the early 19th century that belonged to slaveholders. It became very confusing because, as most of you know, Transylvania did not become a county until right on literally the eve of the Civil War, so we don't have separate documentation. But much of Transylvania, particularly the slaveholding area of Transylvania County, came out of Henderson County. Henderson and Buncombe and along the French Broad and the broader river valleys had a higher percentage of slaves than many other parts of western North Carolina. It wasn't compared to lots of other parts of the South, it was, of course, much smaller. So the first census in 1862, there were 447 slaves and three free people of color. And that's significant because it really shows that there was not the ability to set up separate African-American institutions before emancipation. Because people, if there's only three free African Americans, then there really was very little until emancipation came. Most of the material remains of African Americans are probably archaeological resources now, and I'm sure that there's lots more that can be done archaeologically with African American. We're not archaeologists, and so we couldn't do that work, but it remains to be seen. There's also several places that are believed to have unmarked slave burials, including at St. Paul's of the Valley, and this is a monument to the graves of slaves there. Earlier slave burials at Cooper's, at Cathy's Creek, and the Davidson River. The one house that possibly, and I say possibly, is a freestanding slave quarter that still survives is the Johnson Hume slave quarters in Dunn's Rock. In the first survey, it's called the Johnson slave quarters. Now, Keith Parker, who runs the deeds, does not think it was probably the Johnson family that owned that house and was more likely to have been the Humes. And so more people would know it as the Baxter house. And White family bought it, the Raxters. And it's really oral tradition that says it's a slave house, but luckily it's only separated by a generation. Granny Raxter He's and his cousin remember her. They took care of her, went to an old woman who she had been told when the family moved in that it had been a slave. We do not have further documentation. I was a little skeptical when I first looked at the house because from the outside it looks very much like a late 19th century vernacular saddlebag house. However, going inside, you can easily see that there is an older house in there. We couldn't definitively date it, but there are things that it possibly could indicate being slave quarters. It's got a brick central chimney rather than stone, which is much more common for vernacular buildings. It's got hearths on the second floor, which is fairly uncommon in this form of house. And it's got this interesting divided staircase leading completely separate rooms. So you can see how the way it was built could have possibly been to accommodate four families rather than a single family. Again, that's not a smoking gun, but does give some credence to the fact that this may have been a slave quarters. This house is somewhat endangered. The family needs to find a home for it, so this if it is indeed a slave quarters, it's a very significant building. But it would probably take a lot more work, possibly archaeological work as well, to do further documentation. After emancipation, we see the creation of African-American institutions, and particularly sort of a consolidation of communities. That some of the townships that had African-American slaves, they left and moved, particularly to French Broad, like Lake Creek area, as well as Shady Grove right at the edge of Brevard. And so those became the major communities. And one of the significant things is not the survival of necessarily old buildings, but of old institutions, and particularly the churches. The fact that there's four Baptist churches that are all over 100 years old, two of which date from the period of emancipation. One is French Broad, and again, the early churches would have been very provisional, but and this is the oldest church, in fact, but it dates from the 1960s, so it's not greatly old. But the church, as an institution, dates more than 150 years. Bethel is the other one that dates from period right after emancipation. Again, moved around quite a bit, moved to this neighborhood near Rosenwald. Was near the train tracks, that was too noisy, and then in the very early 20th century moved to its current site and has continued to be rebuilt. Splitting off from French Broad in the early 20th century, Glade Creek on the other side of the river was built. Again, it's been rebuilt several times. This is now the education building that was the older sanctuary, dates from the early 1960s, from the 1960s, the new sanctuary. And then Bethel A, which split from Bethel in 1919, and some of you probably know, just celebrated its 100th anniversary. So these became kind of the nucleus. There were other African American churches as well, but these are the ones that have that long history. African-American cemeteries that I've mentioned before. French Broad has an amazing one that goes up the hill behind it. Includes the grave of Jim Aiken, who was one of the most prominent African-American citizens in the county in the late 19th, early 20th century, owned several businesses, and was also Mom's favorite's father. Cooper's, which probably has earlier cemetery or slave and earlier graves adjacent in the older part, but this part of Cooper's was created in the early 20th century. A lot of the people that we learned about in our histories are very, a lot of prominent people are buried at Cooper's. Also Shady Grove and Bailey that are not accessible to the public, that they're packed across private land and they have to know where the cemeteries are to find them. And then Davidson, which is both a white and a black cemetery that's segregated. Again, there's some belief that there might be some site burials, but in the early 20th century, there was a plot of land that was deeded from a cemetery club most of them were members of the Glade Creek Church. And there's been a lot of documentation of the cemetery, the people who maintain Davidson River Cemetery, both in the white and black community. And they've been working with Western Carolina University on ground penetrating radar to locate a lot of the unmarked graves. So, again, an amazing amount of research already been done. One of the time periods, I guess, that we focused on quite a bit was this period between 1910 and 1963, which was sort of the period of industrialization and growth of African American communities, particularly here in Brevard. And the two sort of major events were the sequential building of two schools, first the industrial school and then the Rosenwald School, and the construction of the tannery in Brevard that really helped consolidate and make the African American community grow. The industrial school is less known and kind of continues to be a bit of a mystery. From the Brevard News, they report a three-story building has grown up among us, unheralded and almost unknown to our citizens, obviously the white citizens. I'm sure the African American citizens knew all about it. It was three stories tall. They were contemplating a second building for boys that would be even larger. J.H. Johnstone, a physician from Knoxville, moved to run the school. We know the school was there because the Sanborn Insurance Map in 1911 clearly has the school, two buildings there. Unfortunately, it's an inset, so it doesn't give the exact location, but it is described as being, it's once Main Street is extended, that's where it is. And so it does show up in that map. We know from Hall's history that he said, well, a woman named Pruden was involved with this somehow. And we're pretty certain that was Emily Pruden, who created a lot of African American schools in North Carolina, including Lincoln Academy over at Kings Mountain, which Elsie Betzel went to, among the other citizens from Brevard, and Dr. Johnstone's wife, Wilkie. And she's probably the connecting person between this and the Rosenwald School. The reference to Jim Aiken is interesting because he was the person who would have had the means and the influence to make sure the school was built. He died 2 months before this news article in a fire truck accident here in Brevard. He was active with the fire. And so the Johnstones moved in. But we know that we found a deed that Mrs. Pruden had bought land and for a dollar had deeded it to the Johnstones. Dr. Johnstone died within another year or two of the creation of the school. And so probably the industrial school was never as large as they originally planned. And so you see sometimes that the Rosenwald School is dated to 1910, which is not accurate because the Rosenwald Fund didn't exist then. But for those of you who are not familiar with the Rosenwald school program, Julius Rosenwald was the son of German Jewish immigrants, became president of Sears Roebuck, was very inspired by the writings of Booker T. Washington, met Washington, who convinced them that what the real need was to build African-American elementary schools in the South, and thousands of schools were built. The Brevard School is listed in the Fisk University records as being built 2021 under Tuskegee. I don't know how accurate that date is. What it means, though, is they moved, about 21, they moved the offices of the Rosenwald Fund from Tuskegee to Nashville. And so the school here was built before that. It was one of the older of the Rosenwald schools. North Carolina, incidentally, has more Rosenwald schools than any other state, so there's been a lot of effort to document them. And this is just a quote from the North Carolina Multiple Property Nomination Form. This is the original frame Rosenwald School, what it looked like. It was a three-room. A lot of them were only one and two rooms. Brevard had a three-room school, so this would have been the school that Elsie Betzel would have remembered attending. And from the location, this is the Sanborn map from 24, And so it's on the other side of Main Street from where the current Roosevelt School is. And this leads us to believe that the industrial school was more or less on the same site, because this is the only two-story house in the immediate Roosevelt area, and we know that the Wilkie Johnstone's house was two stories, and she was across the street. The deed actually sits across the street from the industrial school, and then her house was across the street from the original Roosevelt school. So they were probably more or less. What happened to that first school, we don't know. What happened, unfortunately, to the second school in the early 1940s was burned to the ground. And then, as many of you probably know, for 7 years there was no African American school at all. I'm sure the war had something to do with that, but African American kids met at Bethel A, at Bethel, and there was an AME church also right there, and so that's where they went to elementary school. So we see the growth of the Roosevelt community, and particularly the area immediately around where the school was. Pickles-Imers was Mills Avenue. But if you look closely, which you probably can, at this is, again, the insurance maps, 24 and 31. These are all marked dwellings. There was not a lot of business in the area except for the store right here that's listed as one story and then becomes two stories. And that's the Jip Mill store, which is still standing. So it was a residential community, but it became kind of the heart and soul of the African-American community. And so this is a really tremendously important building. It's the oldest surviving African-American business in Brevard. Now, Jip Mills was a community leader from the 19-teens. He was involved with, the creation of the first industrial school. And then many of the people who went to Roosevelt that we interviewed remember Mr. Jip going to buy candy from him in his later years. And some of the typical houses that we documented around the Roosevelt School, many of them were sort of this typical small one-story house, side gables. This is the Tom Wynn house. One of the people we interviewed talked about Tom Wynn as being one of the little red birds who kept an eye on the kids and would tell parents if the kids got out of line, too. So that was kind of a story that we liked, so we were glad that we had Tom Wynn's house. That was Jip Mill's house, more of a bungalow with a high peaked roof. And so these are kind of the typical houses. The tannery opened in about 1917 and had a great influence in developing this area. Down below Roosevelt, on the other side of the tracks from the Roosevelt community. This is 31, and there's I think at least six store buildings right there at that intersection. So this became the hub of the commercial life for African Americans by the 1930s. It was known to a lot of people as Greasy Corner. Some people took that as a slur, and some other people said, no, that's what its name was. The story is that that referenced the tannery. We know that the tannery actively recruited African Americans out of South Carolina and Georgia. Two prominent families that moved and built in the Greasy Corner area, the Betzels, Elsie's parents. That house is still in the family. And Victor Betzel worked for a short time in the tannery and then went back to his skill as being a barber, opened the barber shop. Up where the lodge building is, and that became kind of a center for nightlife as well as haircutting and store and stuff. The Kilgores, this was originally a one-story house that we had expanded. I think there were 12 kids. Many of the Kilgores went on to become very prominent citizens, including Thomas Kilgore Jr., who was a worked with Martin Luther King, civil rights, became a civil rights leader. There's a wonderful interview with him in the UCLA archives that we used a little bit. So just a little bit about Greasy Corner. It was where the nightlife occurred. There were cafes, stores, juke joints, plus Bethel, of course, and Clifford, Outlaw Ranch, and some of the other communities. Goose Holler, the Flats, those were all names. Elsie talked about people used to come for the weekends. They'd come down here to dance. And they come from as far as Hendersonville, Asheville, and Thursday, people who worked as domestics and moved here for the summers would come down because they had Thursdays off. And so Greasy Corner was jumping. It's hard to kind of imagine now, but it was a great place for nightlife there. We also look kind of as a separate, this is Greasy Corner. We look at Rosenwald, Greasy Corner, and then coming down closer to where the tannery was, Jenkins Row, what used to be Mill Avenue, and Duckworth. This is Hemphill Circle now. And you can see all the housing that was coming in, most of it African-American as well. And some of the types of housing that would have been built for mill workers. We were also happy to find Mama Rose's house because Mama Rose came up in a lot of the stories too, and she was a relative of Mom's Mabley. When Mom would come back to visit, she had her Cadillac parked in front of Mama Rose's house. So.
Can you go back to the slide before that one?
Yeah.
Where's the railroad?
The railroad is up here. Okay. So this is the cannery, this is the creek. So this is going up, so the rubber would be right up there.
Alright.
One of the few two-story houses is the Howell House, which is right next to the site, and this is where the footbridge would have been across, going across to the tannery. Mary Alice Mooney told us about, she grew up on Creek Bank, right down on the creek next to the. And then after her father passed away, they bought a Gibraltar prefabricated house and moved up to Hemphill Circle. But she had described what it was like earlier. When we were younger, we slept in the same bedroom. My three brothers in one bed, and my sister and I in the other. And since I did a lot of interviewing of people who grew up in log houses, when I did my dissertation, very similar sorts of stories about how people may do with these large families. That's how close it was. They carried their furniture just up the hill to their new house, which is still there. We also did a segment on the architecture of domestic service, and particularly at Cedar Mountain. There turned out to be a nice small collection of houses that were servants' houses that were freestanding. And so we documented several of those. The oldest one is the Beckwith Hanahan House. Reverend Beckwith built his house, I think, in the 19-teens. The house that became the servant's house was originally built for his daughter, who had tuberculosis, so it was not built as a servant's house. But after the Hanahan family bought it, they converted it to a servant's quarter. And it was positioned, as many of the servant's quarters, to the back, but not too far distant. From the main house, so it preserved a little bit of privacy for the servants who came up. They would come from South Carolina, Georgia, one of families from Texas, and stay in the summer. One of the best preserved ones is at Wild Away, and one of the nice things about this, we actually know the full name of the man who lived in this house, Lee Freeman. A lot of people remember him, Mary Louise, only by their first name, but because of the woman who owns the house, it was her uncle's house, and so she remembered very distinctly Lee Freeman, who was both the chauffeur and the cook and whatever else. So his house was a combination of the garage as well as the three rooms that had been extended. Then one of the questions questions is, you know, these people must be, it must have been very isolating for these African American domestic servants that came up in the summer. And there, people called, we were called Patty Salt particularly, there was this natural outcropping of rock, and that became sort of the place people gathered. It's across from the store, and we don't have an official name for it, so we call it Gathering Rock. But there are historic pictures of African Americans on Sunday afternoons and Sunday evenings having picnics, gathering at this rock. Probably as transportation group too, that they, you know, Elsie Betzel talked about driving his dad's car up and as far as Caesar's Head and down to, so some of these people also probably went to Greasy Corner on a Thursday night, but the Gathering Rock was an important gathering place for this community, for African Americans. We also wanted to talk a little bit just specifically about African American building arts. Stonemasonry, especially Fred Ethel Mills' house. Ethel Mills was famous in her own right. She started teaching at Rosenwald in the mid-20s and was acting principal forever until desegregation. And in fact, we're doing a little kind of open for a project in Franklin where we live, because Ethel Mills was born in Franklin. Her father was a preacher there. He built St. Cyprian's Church. And so they want to recognize her and their Women's History Trail. So we're looking forward to that. But Fred Mills was a stonemason. He only had one arm. So he was a pretty amazing man, was involved with a lot of the stone projects in the community. And then he trained Avery Benjamin, who built the house up the block. Both of these houses were frame houses. And so it's like they took their personal house to sort of display their own, and I think particularly the Benjamin house, which is well preserved, I think is still owned by the family. All the different types of stonework, if you look closely at the house, that he used to kind of display his skills. The other thing is, if you just walk around the Rosenwald community, is how much stonework, even if the houses are gone, just lining corners and stones, steps, and you know, just as we kind of walked around, there's a lot that was probably built by Avery Benjamin or Fred Mills. Fred Mills also worked on Brevard Gates, along with the Wright brothers from Hendersonville. They possibly were the people that trained him. I'm sure all of you are familiar with that. It's on the National Register. And then he also built the arch at Silverstein Park. So this represents probably one of his very first and his very last projects, because we have heck of a time trying to date Silverstein Park, but it was quite close to the very end of his life. But we have pictures of him standing in front of the arch, so. And then that landscape masonry I was talking about, that you could, you know, if the houses are overgrown, or you can see a lot of that work. Edith Berry told us that this was probably built by Fred Mills and Quillike Glaze, who I believe lived there, who often worked for Fred Mills as well. So another part of the history that can be documented. And then the boarding steps that went up to the Mabel and Conjure Sharp boarding house. There were two boarding houses, actually. There was one here and one there that served the African American community that was torn down. You can see the foundation of the Sharp House right here. And this amazing sort of double staircase still survives. We heard a lot about Brick Lane as well. And Morris Young, particularly, whose father taught at Ninth Avenue in Hendersonville, and sort of the way he described was his father's aesthetic was in laying bricks. Son, listen, when you lay a brick, just don't lay it just to be laying it. Lay it with neatness. Reason being, you've got less to clean up afterwards. And he said, lay it like it should be laying. When you look down a wall, you don't want to see a snake. That'll speak for you. People will call you back, you know, see what you're doing, good work. And then Clifford Outlaw said, talking about program at Ninth Avenue, You didn't know whether you or not you were going to college. They had courses in Rick Masonry, and it seemed like all the kids, all the male boys from Brevard were required to go. And yes, I took Masonry, entered a state contest in laying bricks. Somewhere around here, I had a trowel that was given to me as a prize. But the best Mason in our class was Max Robinson. He could lay some rocks, lay some bricks. Another good one was Dave Ballard out of Great Lake Creek. He could lay some rocks and bricks, very good. And then Charles cuts in and said, they were artists. So the changes to the Rosenwald School, as I said, in 41, this original school was consumed by fire. For about 7 years, they met in the churches. The new Stone School opened in 48. When it wasn't actual Rosenwald School, it was referred to as the Brevard School, Brevard School. But it was named Rosenwald, so it kind of carried on the history of Rosenwald. It's technically not a Rosenwald School, because it was a public school, but the community very much saw it as their school and saw it as being in direct line with the Rosenwald tradition. I meant to point out earlier with the Rosenwald schools, Rosenwald himself and the fund only provided seed money, so the African-American communities, as well as local white communities, had to find money to build this school. So it was not just like, here, have an elementary school. These were the schools that were built from the ground up with a lot of community effort. So most of the people, when you talk to them, when they remember Rosenwald, they remember this school, which I think should be on the National Register, even though maybe not, would not fit into the state's definition of a Rosenwald school, I think, because of that heritage of education. I love Sheila Marie's quote. So my world consisted of Rosenwald Elementary School and Bethel Way Baptist Church. Anything that went on in my life happened in that little divot. Clifford Outlaw talked about how bright he went after attending school in basements of churches that he went in. And the Rosenwald schools, particularly the later ones, were built to capture the light. They were very, innovative plans that were and really changed how schools black and white were built. And Morris Jones, who said, as far as our education, I think we had the best overall educational program for the black community, and mainly because our teachers had this attitude that we were their kids. It was one-on-one, and they wanted to instill in us that we were better than what some said, and that we are, and to let us know that we could learn, we could go on in life and get an education. And so that's what this building really meant. And then, again, as most of you know, in Brevard, after people finished at Rosenwald, there was no secondary education available for black students in the county. We chose a very long quote from Edith, but I think it really captures. We went to Rosenwald from grades 1 to 8, and suddenly you're in 8th grade, and you have this real decision to make, or your parents are making it for you. And you said, well, you know, am I going to go to school at the high school? And you knew you were young, your spirit is young, because you're not coming from a big city where you're used to jumping in a car or a bus and just going on your own. So you had to wait for their decision for you, where you were going. And she described some of the schools, the Allen Home School, which Mary Alice went to. Robert Kilgore went to Wilmington, Elsie Benzel went to Lincoln Academy. Some people went far afield because they had relatives, or there were people in the community that were willing to give them scholarships or help support them. But to imagine being just out of eighth grade and be having to leave your family. And Mary Alice said that, you know, once you went to the Allen School, you didn't have to come home on the weekends. And so she would plead to stay in Brevard, even though she knew she was getting a free education. Now, the majority of the children, if you couldn't afford to go to a private school or had someone who lived up north or somewhere you could go and stay within maybe for 6 months of the school year, then you went to Ninth Avenue. Some of the kids wanted to go, others didn't. But really, most of us didn't have a choice, you know. We wanted to finish school. And so the busing to, you know, 42 miles a day on what was then a very windy road from here to Hendersonville and things were kind of cold and crowded. It wasn't the school itself, they were critical, but the place, and the fact that, you know, her parents paid taxes, and they could not find an education in the county. So, trying to sort of capture what buildings mean, and Albert Benjamin became a very successful person, came back for the reunion, I think in 2001 at 9th Avenue, and I think the way he said it, I do not have a problem with celebrating 9th Avenue, but I do have a problem with celebrating the idea behind 9th Avenue. I think that's important with all, while people were very nostalgic about the communities that they lost and the school that they lost, it's not meaning that segregation was better or that celebrating segregation, but that they did feel a loss for what they had. I think that sense of community particularly. And Loretta Knox may come out, the one part of the family that still left is the chimney. She said, they say that we've got this historical thing, which is the chimney down there. I don't find that stuffy to me, except that got bath and rats coming out of it. Our historical thing was the community center and our school, our little area that we had with the little stores and stuff. You know, that was what was important in memory. And the sense, I think, the other thing that people talk to a lot, and I think that one of the take-home messages for that Cindy and I had was, which really surprised me, was people talk a lot about how safe they felt. And it really showed how much African-American parents tried to protect their kids. And they weren't allowed to go downtown to see the segregation when they were young. And they knew that people were looking out for them. And so they really talked about their communities in terms of safety, which is kind of surprising considering the era. This is just to summarize the documentation we did, the oral histories and transcriptions, which Cindy valiantly did. We documented 86 new properties. We updated 15 previously documented properties, and we submitted a 98-page report. So, one of the things that we tended to ask people, what do you want people to know about your community? And again, Sheila, you kind of summed it up. Yes, life was safe. They protected us from all the misery that was actually going on. Like, we weren't allowed to go to town without an adult to see the colors only or whites only, and certain places we couldn't go. So growing up poor, safe, and protected, that's it. And Mary Alice, we said, we specifically said, what do you want people to know? That we never give up. You may knock us down, but still we rise. We fight, and we always have setbacks, but we're always moving forward. And we intend to win whatever battle we undertake. And I can't say that any battle we have undertaken is for anything. That's it. Are there any questions? Comments?
Thank you.
Anything to add, Cindy?
Oh, I was going to say, if you're super interested in the 98-page report, you can find it at the library.
Yes.
Along with the oral history interviews and the transcriptions, if you want to read more or listen more to these stories from people in their own words and their own voices, we certainly encourage you to go down to the library and have Marcy help you with that.
Plus, all the copies of the architectural documentation, which will go to the Asheville office in Raleigh, a copy and we'll be here in the Timberland County Library, so everything will be good.
I was just going to say that thank you so much. This was absolutely fascinating, and I'm on Brevard City Council, and you know, there's just so much history down in that area, and you see the remains of things, and you don't quite know what they are, like those steps. I didn't realize those steps, which I see all the time, was a boarding house, and so to me, preserving, as you have done, you know, is so important to our community. And I know that, you know, there's such pride that is taken by the Rosenwald community in particular, as the community in the city that I'm most familiar with. But I also know that there's also a project, I know Nicola's working on a project where she's going to be putting markers to document as part of our, you know, across different places in the city, so that you almost can have like a walking trail. And, you know, and seeing, even if the house isn't there, you know, what used to be there. And so I think this all just ties together, and that's a great project that really is sort of a follow-on to a lot of documentation that you've done here. And so just thank you so much.
And thank the people who had the vision to see that oral history was important for this, because it would have been so hard to have, for us coming from the outside, to have made sense of what all of it was without that sort of the interviews that we did and people. And I mean, it was the most amazing. We documented all the houses, and you know, because we could go all the way up to 1975 in our project, and we sat down with her and projected it on a screen like this. She nailed every single one. It was what, about 60 properties that day? And she had a genealogy for, because, oh, so-and-so lived there, and then so-and-so, you know, and we had a story for every single house that we had documented, and it was just absolutely amazing. Did you have a question?
Well, I grew up in Chapel Hill, and we've been in the county since the 70s, and it's just interesting that I graduated in the 60s from high school, the early 60s, and we had no African-Americans in our high school class. In Chapel Hill in Orange County, where the university was. Transylvania County, I learned later, was the first county in the state of North Carolina to integrate. And part of it was that their kids were having to be bused to Hendersonville. But they tried to find a lawyer in the county, and they couldn't find one, so they found one in Asheville, who won the case after Brown versus Board of Education. And so some of the folks that you talked with were some of the first to integrate.
And it really,
I'm sure all of you know the wonderful documentary that was done about our football team and our marvelous coach who was going to stand up for his players and did. And so Transylvania County has a lot to be proud of.
And it was so hard for those students. I mean, that was all. Even though it was a great victory
in terms of that
area. To talk to the people that were that first generation to go to Brevard High, and even someone like Edith Dardy, who only went 1 year, her first, but her last year was at, and she was like, kept her head down because she wanted to finish school, you know, but it, the courage it must have taken,
yeah,
to, and also the loss for African American teachers who lost their jobs, yeah, as part of the desegregation, too, which is part of the story that Mormon doesn't make.
Brevard High School was integrated in 1963. That was the first year of the Brevard High School state championship football.
Yeah. Yeah.
I heard this story, and it's probably true, that after the game, they were on the bus back home. They stopped in a little restaurant to eat, and they wouldn't let them come inside. So the white guys got their food and took it out and beat on the bus with the white guys.
I was in the first integrated class at Hickory High School, and we had the same thing happen, and that's what we did.
It's a real tribute to people all over the community that, you know, that happened, that we stood up for each other.
So I hope particularly that the oral history components continue. I know that as outsiders, we had to earn a lot of trust, and we really thank the folks that made it possible, because people didn't have any reason to. We got confused for all sorts of things. We're asking them. We were Jehovah's Witnesses. But it was so wonderful to hear people's stories. I mean, that was such a treasure.
You mentioned about the Masons and stuff.
Yeah.
There's a couple of people, the Clippers. And, I wondered, Bob, would they have been, when Bob Merrill, do you think he would have come in contact with any of those people? Or was that too.
Bob Merrill was here for an awful long time.
Yeah.
In masonry.
Yeah, because I know he laid the brick on my house, and I live in now.
And so did the Morris.
I do business with his son-in-law all the time, you know, and it'd be cool to go back and see if, I'm sure he would have picked up a lot of African-Americans with his business and stuff out of this county.
I can't believe that he wouldn't have.
Yeah.
And I know, Morris Young, when he talked about coming back and wanted to be a Mason, and by that time, sort of, it was all the big companies and independent Masons were sort of no longer a part of it. But, yeah, I think the work that the Wright brothers did, that a lot of the early stone houses here in Fort Ward, and they brought in Fred Mills, and so they were three white brothers, and they worked with Fred and then Fred Mills, who then did a lot of the subsequent building. So lots of interesting, and lots of stories still to be told.
Now, the oral history interviews, they weren't originally part of the scope, were they?
They weren't the scope from the money that comes from Archives of History.
Okay.
But there was Rebecca, you probably know history, but
that was from the National Historic Preservation Trust, that was where the part.
Yeah, it was a special fund within the National Trust, I believe. So, yeah, so Archives of History doesn't even know what to do with oral histories. It's like not part of what they do, but I mean, they understand the work we do, but I think it made it so much more richer a project, and I think we just wouldn't have been able to get the level of understanding. We could have gone and taken a picture of every building in a neighborhood that was older than 1975, and you would have had a lot of pictures of buildings, and we could have talked to people, but to have the actual interviews.
Who's maintaining these cemeteries now that are on private land?
That's a good question. I think because they're on private land, there is a commission, though.
That abandoned cemeteries is another group that Transylvania County has. Joe Chapman is the chair of that. And I'm on that chair. And basically, technically, our job isn't to maintain. We're not supposed to maintain. We don't have to maintain cemeteries. Our job is to just make sure they're marked and they're protected. But a lot of times, I know the city has done some of the cleaning. I feel like they've cleaned maybe dailies. We have cemetery cleaning days, and a lot of times you get permission from the property owners, and you get the community to go do that. So we make sure it stays, and no one does. You know, we make sure if there's a stone tablet or something, we can do something about that. But there's some groups that do days, cleaning days, where you go in and do.
I think some of them clean the Moore and Thomas cemeteries out of DuPont.
Very likely.
Well, thank you all again, and thanks for the patience of listening to us.
There you were.
I'll let you all get on with your business. Thank you so much.
Give us a contact.
Do you realize under the Vance Monument, in Ashland, there used to be underground restaurants? color than white.
Yep.
I tell you, it's just. You
know, Bob says I can last a mile to the outhouse.
What's that?
About the restrooms that used to be under the Vance Monument on Pack Square?
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now those go way back. Yeah. But those were colored in white.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jack, my office was on 13 at the courthouse when I was working over there. You could walk, look out the window and see the showers that they built out there in the open for the people. The fountains. People out there bathing in the fountains all day long.
She talked about it. They stayed in that area.
Things were different back then.
What are you talking about? Saying like Grease Corner?
Well, I mean, it was what you said. I mean, it was called the colored section of town. I mean, that's just what it was called, you know? Mm-hmm. We had them in Asheville. You know, just. Yeah. I mean, I just. It's just.
Where exactly was Greasy Corner? Because, see, I haven't been here for 11 years. Because it's not easy to read those
maps. Well,
most
of them had jobs at the tannery. And the tanneries were in Greasy Corner. Not that it was a racist term or anything, but I think, yeah, grease is very greasy in tanneries. I've been in tanneries before.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's just like, if that's where the industrial jobs were, I can see it become just a slapstick name on it.
Well, it was just like the old sawmills at the Rossman in the country store.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you that the black people were probably paid in script at the tannery.
Mm-hmm. They were very well loved
it. Well, it's just like nowadays, they call what you're saying, Greasy Corner, they call it the corner.
Yeah.
And then it's still a sawmill in Rossman. The wood your lumberyard had from at the time is referred to.
My brother was a bombardier, B-17, stationed in Italy in World War II. He told the story of they were on a mission and the fighters, our fighters, came up and escorted them. They had red tails.
Tuskegee Airmen.
Well, let me tell you, they put their lives on the line just like every white person did.
I tell you, that little boys could fly too.
Right.
They black fly.
Mm-hmm. The legend is they never lost a single bomber to the German fighter.
That's the legend.
That was. Did they request to speak to us? Did you ask them to come in? How did that work?
Yeah, they wanted to present their findings to the community, and they asked if they could come present.
That's nice.
Did you really? I mean. She came prepared for what she does. I mean, that was a great presentation for what it was intended for. So.
Yeah.
The only time they could do it, we were going to try to get them to come in September, but
they
conflicts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the report's in his upstairs in the library. That's great. Subdivision approvals and updates, Kate.
So there were 17 total last month.
Oh, I didn't get one. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Sorry.
So eight of those were just recombinations. There were three family subdivisions, two changing of boundary lines, three two-lot subdivisions, and then one was review only.
I don't think I got a copy.
When they do a review, is that just to make, like, maybe the boundary lines aren't absolutely clear and they just flood?
The review one?
Yeah.
So Jason had signed off on that, so I'll turn it over to him.
Which one's that?
When it's a review.
Typically, that's when someone's just wanting to. They're wanting something recorded, and they're not really dividing any property, but they want our signature before they can record it at the courthouse.
Oh, okay.
So typically that's what that is.
Okay.
So, Kate, if we, a 1.9, a change of boundary lines between adjoining property owners, mm-hmm. would be a good example of what?
So, one that we see a lot is the motor coach resort. A lot of times they'll have their boundary line and then they'll extend it like a tenth of an acre, and so that would be a good example of that. Or if, so with one, we had, there was one parcel was split with a road, and so they were changing that boundary line just to kind of match what the road said. So those are a couple of examples.
Basically just technical changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Old business. Noise ordinance update.
The noise ordinance isn't going to the Board of Commissioners this month for discussion. Their agenda's full, and with the timing of the holidays, they figure it's going to take a couple of meetings, so they're going to hold off on anything until January time frame, but I'll keep you all up to date.
So when are we going to give it to them, or do they have it already?
They've seen it.
Okay.
It's just not going to be on the agenda for discussion until January.
Okay. Our poor noise ordinance. Okay, Cedar Mountain, small area plan. We've worked so hard on it.
We had a meeting last night. The committee's working towards the, they have a preliminary boundary that they're working with. And I gave them some ordinances, design guidelines from neighboring localities that have done area plans. They're going to be studying that, taking what they think might be pertinent and trying to come up with a potential framework for discussion at our January meeting, which they're not going to meet in December.
Okay.
So they'll be meeting January 28th, and we'll continue with to update you all on the progress.
And you'll meet at their.
We're meeting at community. We're meeting at the community center as of this month.
What time are those meetings?
6:00.
New business. Planning and community development department update.
I don't have any major updates outside of the noise ordinance and Cedar Mountain small area plan, but I do want to let you all know that we have completed our interviews for the planner position, and we're moving forward with a candidate, and I'll know more probably by the next meeting how we have a permanent planner position filled.
Oh, it is filled.
It's not filled yet. We finished the interviews, and we're checking references and potentially making an offer, but we'll probably have everything firmed up by the next meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, Beth will still be with us.
Yes.
Planning board members. Trisha Hogan needs to know if Beecher, Lauren, and myself are interested in serving another term because our terms expire in January.
I did resubmit to her already.
Okay. Did you get an email from her?
I think on my personal email, I need to go back through it.
Yeah, I did hear from her.
Check. Are you going for it?
I'm still thinking. I'm not sure yet. You just arrived, so I have to assume.
Yeah, I'll give it a go.
We didn't scare you off already, did we?
How much is the term? Was it 6 month terms? Or?
Well, 2 or 3 years.
2 years.
We were three.
Okay.
Or the 3 years. It might be 3 years.
Yeah.
I thought it was two, but it could be three.
One of us was two. That was you, Kimsey. And you. That was you. You had a 2 year term.
Yeah, I have
3 years. And he's in his third. Second term for 3 years this time, right? Or two?
No, my first term was a partial term.
Oh,
right.
This is my first full 3 year term.
Okay.
So each of us is only for 3 years, right?
Yeah. You have another year. Mm-hmm. Right,
yeah, I guess I'll be able to go.
And John, hopefully, you know. Well, he doesn't. Oh, no, he just came on, so he has 2 more years. planning board.
Yeah, where is John? John's the one that called me and tried to pull him out of there.
I wish he had been here tonight because he could make it last.
I haven't heard from him.
Supposedly, as you know.
Something must have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's too bad, because he would have enjoyed the presentation, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. Now, C, Transylvania County Email Training Opportunities Mission Statement.
That's just some housekeeping items. I think Beth was trying to set everybody up with an official Transylvania County email, so.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I know. Nobody ever used. I made. Trisha might have emailed me on that email.
She emailed me on it.
Did she? Okay, yeah. That's probably what it was. Yeah. But.
So we've got till how long? I mean, she wants us to go ahead and go through there and follow that email process ASAP, right?
Yeah, as soon as you can.
Okay.
Don't you already have one? You probably already have one.
The one I've had is a state DuPont.
Okay.
Email.
Right. What if we don't do that?
You'll probably get one anyway. But
probably get us.
You probably already have
one. I don't check this one.
Somebody would have to email me to know if it's working. But yeah. Trisha, yeah. I'll email you and see if you get it. But who checks it? I don't check it.
Yeah.
Well, from an official standpoint, you want records to flow through an official source, so it is subject to the records rules and regulations.
But now that we may also for the public to email members of the planning board, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so
and some people, I think you can set it up to where it's forwarded to your personal account.
That's what I did.
Yeah.
That way, if it comes to your personal account, everybody's subpoenaed. Your whole personal account is subpoenaed.
Why it's better just to use the county account.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a reason. It's just like using, if you use your own telephone to take pictures of, say, a crime scene, you can wave your phone goodbye.
I worked in my hometown. I was town manager for a couple of years, and the guy came to the town council meetings all the time, and he found out that the mayor was using his own personal email from Eastman Chemical Company to conduct town business. He filed a Freedom of Information Act request on it, and the mayor, let's just say the mayor begged him to withdraw it so he wouldn't get in trouble at work.
Oh,
and he ended up doing it. He just wanted to make the mayor sweat a little bit.
He probably did.
But let's just say the email started flowing from the official town email after that.
Do we get a Transylvania County email?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I haven't got that yet.
I got a. I haven't done anything about it because
I've had one since we came on board.
Who really? Why?
Oh yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I just got one.
I was told we did, and I couldn't find. Trisha's email, but okay.
All right. It's super easy.
Yeah. Okay. How about training opportunities?
I think while I was talking with the county manager, while we don't have any major directives from the county commissioners, I'm probably going to present some of the new training modules from the UNC School of Government on as it relates to planning boards coming up. So I just wanted to let y'all know about that. We may end up meeting over at the commissioner's chambers to utilize that technology for that.
Kim, do you remember we went to that one at UNC Asheville?
Yep.
And it was fabulous. I have the notes in here somewhere.
I don't know. That's been a while. But
that was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Almost 3 years ago.
And I'm constantly looking for things that if you all are able to attend. I know there's one at Western Carolina at Biltmore Park on January 21st that's updating the state. It's a class on the updated state planning regulations. I'm attending that myself. It's from 1 to 4:30 at the Western Carolina branch that's at Biltmore Park.
We went to something there, too. I don't remember.
Like the ones that used to be at
Palm Tree. I only went to one.
And there's an arboretum.
Yeah, they have them all.
We used to go up in the Palm Tree or there's an arboretum.
They're having them all over the state.
Quasi-judicial.
Western Carolina.
That's always good. Quasi-judicial.
That was really good. You
paper candy, you talk about
it. That was great. The quasi-judicial decisions that will probably be offered pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren Kimsey and I did that one.
Okay.
It was fabulous.
Yeah, it was.
You would really.
And we did one.
Very instructive.
We did one at the Arboretum, too. I don't remember what that was about.
I don't remember this one.
You
might have gone to it by. Did you go by yourself?
I was on the city board.
Maybe so. Yeah.
But I know I drove myself, so.
Yeah. Me and you drove me. We went together to this one.
Yeah. I think I shamed Mark into getting a bus when we went to Israel. I'm not sure.
But I'm looking for stuff for opportunities for y'all to get those things. There's not going to be much around the holidays, but
yeah.
But we'll. Some things will probably open up around springtime.
Sure. Thank you. All right. Mission statement.
You know, we discussed that with John Wayne. I couldn't find anything as far as in the planning board ever adopting a mission statement. And John Wayne had asked that question. And I just wanted to.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything either.
So if you ever heard of one being adopted, let me know. But I haven't seen a record of anything.
I don't think we have.
But. I know John Wayne was mentioning the possibility of the planning board adopting a mission statement to kind of have a focus. But I hesitate to speak for him without him here because that was something that he brought up. But
Well, that would be just like what Cedar Mountain's doing with their mission statement for their small area planning. So this would be a broad for all of us for Transylvania County.
So I would just say right now, just think about what you think that might be. And we may bring it up at the next meeting if John Wayne's here and discuss it as a group. If there's a need for one and what it potentially could be.
Or it couldn't hurt to have a mission statement.
No.
Definitely couldn't hurt.
He could, you know, tell us his thoughts at the next meeting.
Yes.
A failure to plan is a plan
to fail. There's our mission to that.
It's like
our planning for this poor performance.
All right. Public comments, board members, maybe? Anything they'd like to say before we adjourn? Other than I really enjoyed that. And
what did we decide? Are we going to have a meeting in December?
December.
We're going to have a regular meeting in December.
There's one on the. I don't have any major items that I know of. And I know a lot of folks are busy that time of year. I don't know what y'all done in the past as far as canceling.
As long as I've been on the board, we've not canceled.
Yep. We've not had it. I don't remember ever canceling.
I'll be here, just for the record.
So, and that's what I was talking about. We may take advantage of that and try to present some training.
Well, that's
lots,
true.
Lots.
Yeah,
that's a good time.
So we will have one.
That was the plan.
Make it work. Yeah, I didn't say it, but I'm open to training type stuff that you come up with to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure we're.
Okay, so many new members, you know.
Yes, and that's why, talking with Jamie, we thought it might be a good time to go through some of that stuff.
Okay.
And also, I'm coming from Virginia, so North Carolina law is new to me as well.
That's true. And you have to learn your way all around the county. I'm sure the planning office has a really good map, but. You guys know that the Chamber of Commerce has a $6 map that covers the whole county. It's absolutely unbelievable. Have you ever seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Have you? Yeah. Because I didn't know my way around the county. when I first, not, I mean, I'd lived here, but I had not all gone to the coast.
You can go to Rossman, go to the DOT shed after an Okeechobee County Road Foundation.
Yeah.
It's not like that, but it's just a white sheet of paper with black lines on it. It's got all the roads on there by number.
Oh, the old state road
numbers. Old state road numbers, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's, when you get out, like, into the western part of the county, it's both sides, yeah. It's really good.
Yeah, this is great.
What about the people that don't know how to read a map?
The chamber. The chamber has it?
Yeah, the chamber has it.
When did this come out?
I don't know, but I got it 3 years ago. It's wonderful. If we're, you know, like, Rich Mountain, like, just to see what's out there and all that. It was good.
You know, I see one thing right here. Now, if this ever came back up again, all of those names out of Conesty that no one can pronounce, there ought to be a law against that. You ought to hear OCD try to dispatch fire and rescue and EMS to those, and they can't even pronounce it. They have to spell it on the radio. What if we ever had another request like that to come out? Couldn't something that ridiculous be denied?
Because originally,
yeah, you won't get in trouble, yeah.
I don't know.
Because what you have that subdivision plan on?
American Revolution. I don't know. They were names. They had other names before they changed them.
Yeah, but see, they claim those are original Cherokee.
Are they?
I think some of them were made up by somebody that was technically inebriated.
All right, so that's a good idea for December. Anybody, any other comments?
Nice map.
Thank you. I have no comment. Okay, can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second? All in favor?
Okay, everybody will have a good Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
I cannot believe that.
Everybody have a nice Thanksgiving. I'm going to Florida. I'll be back for 4th. I can't wait. Although the weather's been really nice here.
It has been. I'm kind of ready for some winter.
The day's coming.
I'm going to regret it. Do you have family down there?
My husband's family is all down there. We usually go to my Christmas, but we're staying.